listeners, you're listening to the Rough Sketch Podcast. This is episode 53. We are your usual host. My name is Chris.
And my name is Nathan.
I think we're getting pretty slick at this.
Yeah. Despite the fact that, so, in this episode, you'll hear Chris, and he has a little bit. He was probably in the height of his dirty improv cold that he got.
I had a massive brain fart.
Yeah. and now I have it. I don't think I'm suffering as much as Chris did.
Yeah.
But
I did all the suffering for you. It's fine. For a change. But we are speaking to a writer of comics and wonderful things, Jordan Thomas, who's talking to us from Spain, I think. Because that's where he lives at the moment. And Jordan's infamous for writing comics. Most recently, just released Frank on the Farm and the Quarantine comic. But we talk all about this.
Yes.
So let's get on with that chat.
We are talking to Jordan Thomas. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, Jordan Thomas.
Yes, indeed. just checking I got the name right. That's I wrote it down. I was like, did I write it right? Who I know through his kind of writing mostly, but comic book writing. Jordan, is there any other kind of creative outlets that I don't know about that you would like to mention?
No, I think mainly the comics is the thing at the moment. I studied script writing for film and TV at Bournemouth Uni. So I've written a fair few film scripts and short films and had a few short films made probably 7 or 8 years ago. And I've written a few currently unpublished novels. But yeah, the comics are the things that are going well currently. So we'll stick to that.
That's fair enough. You've just recently been through like a pretty big Kickstarter for you, I think, or it seemed like a pretty big Kickstarter, and that's the re-release of the Frank on the Farm, which was a 4-part comic series, now in one big novel, I'm going to say. Or is it now a graphic novel? I get the words wrong.
Yeah, so Frank, we kickstarted all 4 issues over the course of around 14 months individually, and then it got picked up by Scout Comics, a publisher over in the US, and so they released it like globally into the direct market. But I'm a real fiend for those like hardbacks and omnibus editions and stuff like that, so I'd always kind of had this dream before I started that I wanted to do a really nice hardback collection and release that out to, I guess it's more for, I mean, it's for anyone, but for the fans of the comic on Kickstarter who tend to kind of want something a bit more special. It was kind of like a closing of the chapter on that series for us with a really nice kind of deluxe collection.
Or people like me who completely missed it in the first place. And just kind of found it. It just went, oh, this looks right up my street. I will invest in that.
I've done a few more bits and pieces since we originally did Frank. So, so hopefully there were some new people as well as some returning people wanting to get it in a nice collection who enjoyed the series originally.
That's nice. I mean, I assume it's gone really well. The digital rewards have gone out and they're looking amazing. I assume everything else is going according to plan?
Yeah, pretty much. It's always one of those things where you think, okay, so this will be done then, at this point, this will be done then, and then there's like a page is wrong in the PDF you're sending over to the printer and they send you back the proofs. You're like, oh God, we need to change that. And so you always lose a couple of weeks that you weren't expecting. But I'm waiting for the physical proofs of the hardback to arrive because I live in Spain part of the year. So I'm in Spain at the moment and my printer's over in the UK because the fulfillment company that are going to post everything out's in the UK. And then I'll be back in the UK for Thought Bubble and I want to take a bunch of them over for Thought Bubble. But I'm waiting. It takes a while to get things sent over to Spain at the moment. So, I'm kind of anxious to get the proof so that we can push the button on the final print. But yeah, everything should be in the post for backers within the next kind of 10 days or so.
Sure. And we're recording this at the end of November, so by the time this...
End of October.
What am I talking about? I don't know. What month is it? So by the time this probably goes out, like, hopefully the backers should sort of, like, begin to start receiving their goodies.
Yeah, and Thought Bubble.
And Thought Bubble would have been done and dusted, and we'll all be very tired from that
probably. Yeah, I'll probably we'll have some kind of... picked up some kind of lurgy or something and trying to recover after that weekend.
Yeah. Let's hope not. Is this going to be your first kind of convention back in the real world of conventions? I don't know. Those are the right words.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, because they did some digital versions of conventions. I didn't do any of that. Yeah, this will be my first convention since going to MCM in like August 2019, I guess.
Right.
Oh, actually, no, that's not true. I did do a convention in the north of Spain about a month or so ago in Avilés, but that was more of a kind of a creator meetup type thing where you just kind of sat around outside a hotel and fans could come up and chat to you and get stuff signed and things. It wasn't a traditional English kind of exhibition center and 8 hours stood behind a table kind of deal.
Yeah, just prepare yourself for one of those things. I've never been behind a table for that long a period of time. I don't know if it will ever happen to me. But, like, you know, I can really appreciate the people who do it and the time that they take from it. I'm usually the person on the other side of the table just going, oh, that's nice, I'll buy that. Which is also nice to have. But so if we stick with your sort of script writing and kind of like how did you get started with that? Like, what made you think that's kind of like where my creativity lies?
Well, I was always kind of a insane film fan ever since I was like 3 years old. I can remember things like my dad stayed up with me when I must have been like 4 or 5 years old and Akira was on the TV. The classic manga, and it was in the original Japanese with English subtitles. My dad had to stay up with me as like a 5 year old till like 1 a.m. reading the whole film to me, I remember. So I was always very big into kind of films, and I collected all the I didn't read comics so much as I collected all the trading cards. So I've got folders and folders of the different sets of trading cards, so I knew all the characters and lots of the background and the stories. And then just from there, I did film studies at college, and I really enjoyed the script writing module that we did. So, yeah, then I went off to uni and did that, messed around in trying to get somewhere with film scripts for a while, which is a nightmare. And done a bit of novel writing, but then I've also had a few friends who are involved in comics, and I saw how with Kickstarter you could really get stuff made without, like, with a film, even to make like a small film you need a load of people and quite a lot of money. Kickstarter just kind of gave an avenue where I could write something and find a really great artist, and between kind of the two of us and a letterer and a designer, we could get something out to people, which I guess was what I was missing doing, was actually seeing a finished product at the end of my writing.
Something that I really like to ask writers, especially writers who create comic books, is how do you go about finding the artists that you get on board, and also the letterers as well?
So Clark Bint, who did Frank at Home on the Farm, he had worked with some people I know on a previous graphic novel, and it was kind of when I saw they did a black and white version where all the colors got taken off, and you could really see how amazing Clark's ink work was. And so when I decided to kind of make Frank the thing I was going to push forward with, he was the first person that really came to mind. So I got in touch with Clark, and he came on board pretty much straight away. So I had to get very quickly into getting a fully kind of written script ready for him to get working on. And besides that, I guess once you kind of get into the community and you're on Twitter, you're on Instagram, and even with kind of COVID having kept people from going to conventions and things, you end up kind of chatting to different people, and you can just get a bit of a feeling for who the nice people to work with will be, and obviously if you like their art style. And so there's a lot of it's a lot easier, I imagine, today than if you were trying to do this kind of back in the 80s or something, and it more or less relied on you kind of having a friend who was really good at drawing or a friend who was a really good writer.
The internet being actually useful for a joke.
Yeah. And I guess having that community really lent a helping hand when you created Quarantine as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's a perfect example, really, in that so as I said, I live over in the south of Spain, and they went really hardcore on the lockdown here. As soon as COVID was happening, it was very much you're in your house unless you're like going to the supermarket or going to get medicine, and one person from your house can go. You can't go in a pair. So I'd only really be leaving the house for like an hour every 3 or 4 days or something, and spent a lot of time on Twitter and stuff like that with the extra time. And I noticed that a lot of artists that I like in the small press community were kind of posting back and forth with little sketches they've been doing, or even like their version of a page from Daredevil or Doctor Strange. And I just got the impression that with a lot of people being put on furlough from their day jobs, that people just had a bit more time. So I just had the idea of trying to get as many people together as possible to do something. And that's where Quarantine came from, and the idea of having one whole story but a different artist drawing every page. So yeah, just I got the impression there was people wanted something to do with being kind of stuck inside.
It certainly works really well. I remember sort of backing it and thinking this is possibly an insane project. And I sort of, I didn't really sort of pity you, but I sort of really felt for like, oh God, how are you going to manage this? Mm. But it turned out really, 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 really good. It's just like, not that I doubted it would be really good, but it was just like, this is a great idea, pulling all these people's minds together around one story.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that was the worry, was would it be too jarring moving from one style to the next on each page? And that's the stuff I've been most happy about hearing in reviews of it, that people are like, oh, yeah, like you said, like we thought, oh, maybe this would be a little bit wonky. Maybe it would be hard to kind of keep like grip, kind of fall into the world of the story, I guess, when you were getting these art changes every page, but people seem to find that it worked for them. I think the one thing that I did intelligently there, if I'm to give myself any credit for the project, was that I broke it down into kind of days. So each page was like a day. So scenes never really, until the end when everything's going kind of crazy anyway, and we move into like an hour or 10 minutes and things like that. It was kind of, it was complete scenes, so artists weren't kind of crossing over in the same scene. So you weren't seeing the husband and wife having a conversation, and then suddenly it's the same conversation, but the art's completely changed. So I think that probably helped make that side of it work. But yeah, I mean, I got the amazing artists worked on that book, called Russell Mark Olson, Gustavo Vargas, Clara Meath. Even like we got Sean Phillips at the end, which was incredible, because he's one of my favorite artists of all time.
Yeah, we've actually talked to quite a few of the people. Well, at least two or three of the people that have appeared in the book. Sarah Millman being one of them.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
She was one of our very, very early interviewees.
And Gustavo as well.
So yeah, we're slowly working our way through, sort of like trying to follow up and see. But it I don't know what worked about it. I mean, maybe because I kind of like the sort of surreal nature of it as it gets more and more. I don't want to give away too much just in case people sort of buy it, and I don't want to spoil it too much, but
we recommend people buy it because it's great.
Yeah. And it just gets more and more sort of like out there as I think people feel the quarantine just more and more kind of encasing in on them. Is that sort of you putting your feelings across about quarantine into sort of the writing, or is that just something you just went to play with?
Yeah, I think it's that when doing that idea, I felt like it needed to be something that was relevant to what was going on, but I also didn't want to, you know, people had had enough of hearing about viruses and I didn't want to go that specific. I decided to kind of play on just the idea of suddenly we're used to these lives where, you know, you maybe if you're married or whatever, you're working different jobs and you spend maybe only like 3 or 4 hours together most days, like by the time you're back from the gym or whatever. So what suddenly happens when you're all just forced to be together like nonstop with nowhere to kind of escape to was the part of what was happening globally that I wanted to play with, as opposed to anything too horribly real.
No, I certainly felt it when I was kind of like in that quarantine state within the UK. Yes, it was much less of the UK. I won't get too political about this, about my feelings about how that happened, but I have my feelings and they're quite strong. But even still, when sort of like you're trapped within this world within 6 months, I think it was for us at least, and then it just felt really weird. I was like, I was working one day, and then the next day, I was just like, nope, you're working from home for the next 6 to 8 months at least. And I'm still like kind of in that state for today. And that to me was completely new. So I was just like, how does this work? 1 minute I can't work from home because I'm working for I'm a computer programmer by day. So I work for a business that like have like strict rules about like what can leave the building, including their technology. And then they're just like, no, sorry, gotta work from home. I'm like, okay. Weird.
Yeah, I think because I'm a freelance writer, so I'm pretty well prepared for being made to stay inside, as it's kind of
sure.
It's more or less the day I was having minus the trip to the gym or the supermarket, really. It wasn't a huge change for me. But yeah, for people who, especially for people who a lot of their social life is built around their job and things like that, like you have again, just different types of people, I guess. The people who are quite happy kind of having a lot of time to themselves, and then people that rely a lot on that social aspect of being out at work and chatting with people and things. And I think the psychological side of that was just as important as anything else that was going on for people at the time.
I know I didn't realize how much I appreciated it until it was taken away from me.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was, and then I'm just like, oh, what am I missing in my life? Like 6-7 months later down the line, I'm like, oh yeah, people. Oh yeah, that's what it is. Which is great, you know, it's great to realize, and it's also nice to actually kind of then reconnect with people, like, and especially doing something like this as a podcast, just where I get to chat to creative people about their passions. It's just like, oh, it's like, oh right, that's the bit that I really like. That's the bit that I really like about just interacting with the rest of the world. Maybe I can just do more of that. Who knows? Who knows? Anyway, my tangent aside, I wibbled. Nathan, help me.
Oh, I can't help you with your wibbling. So I mean, like a lot of your work is definitely sort of based around horror or sort of that thriller. Aspect, is that something that you're greatly into? Is that you said that you were into films very early on. Was it always sort of that horror element that you're always drawn to?
Not specifically, I don't think. I'm pretty kind of wide reaching in my various tastes, I guess. Yeah, with the comics, especially between Frank and Quarantine, there was a fair bit of horror in there and sci-fi, but I always really loved kind of crime and mafia films growing up, like your kind of classics, your Goodfellas and The Godfather and things like that. So I've done some of that as well with a series called Mugshots with a longtime friend of mine called Chris Matthews. So that's completely in the Brubaker and Phillips criminal kind of world. I guess I thought of it as like a criminal but set in the UK instead of the US, really inspired by Darwin Cook's Parker books and things like that. But yeah, definitely I do probably, in terms of just the ideas I have, they often lean towards at least quite putting the characters into dangerous and unpleasant situations, at least. So I don't know what that says about me, but yeah, that seems to be the way my brain goes.
We try not to analyze these things. We're not trained for such bits. Yeah, I just wrote down the word characters just because, like, it just seems to be that you're like, where do these characters come from? So are they pulled from just real life, or is it just the? Actually, let me rephrase that question. Do you find the characters first in your mind? That does everything stem from a particular character, or does the story reveal the character? Maybe it's both.
I think it's a bit of both. In the, I'm not like a I guess like a Chris Nolan is very much story and plot first as opposed to character, to the point where by Tennant he'd just kind of done away with emotions in his characters. But then I'm also not someone who just kind of creates some characters and lets them go off. But normally there'll be kind of a situation. So with Frank, it was the idea of a soldier coming home from war to their family's farm and finding that the family are completely missing. And I always kind of had the idea of the strangeness with the animals kind of going from there. But then Frank, I kind of, what is this? Who is this character? What's happened to them in the past? What do I know that they've experienced? I do a lot of kind of thinking about what's happened before the story starts. So what have the characters experienced before they've entered the story? And then from there, I do just try and let them then get on with the story without me so much. Like, I put them in this situation and then hopefully I know them well enough that they can kind of react to things and have conversations which are more like me just being like, okay, this is what this person that I know really well would say in this situation. And definitely, yeah, like with Weird Work, which is my series I'm doing at the moment with Shaky Kane, which is a kind of a LA Confidential in the world of Futurama type story, I've got like a 20-year timeline going back before the story about all these different character interactions and things that have happened, which may not actually pop up in the story in the end, but
it's
I know
for
about
you as a reference.
Yeah, it informs the characters, it informs the relationships, and it does mean that I can kind of grab little kind of nuggets of dialogue that make the world feel like a real lived-in world as opposed to just something that started when you kind of arrived on page one and then finishes at the end. Like, I want it to feel lived in and for there to be history amongst the characters.
I can relate to that, as I do. The other thing that I do sort of creatively apart from programming is improv. So people give me characters on stage and I learn about my character pretty much in the moment that I'm doing it. But in my head every now and again, it's just like, oh, this could be connected because of this and because of this. So it's like I make up the story later on, maybe once the scene has finished and I can sort of fill in those gaps and then pull those into like another scene that this character could be in. So for me, that sort of having that lore for a character is like, it's just so like really nice to be able to kind of have that. And so you just got like this little like treasure chest of nuggets of information about these characters that people may never see. But I think knowing that as a writer and as a creator, that's really useful.
So I think it shows in the writing. Like when you, the worst thing for me, if I'm reading something, is when characters do something or say something that just doesn't feel, you can feel that it's the writer trying to push something in a particular direction. Like they want the story to go this way, even if it doesn't feel natural for the characters, or they've got a political idea or some kind of concept that they're really desperate to put across. So they're putting these very kind of speechy lines into characters' mouths. Like I always tend to read stuff out loud after I'm kind of done with a scene and just see, does it feel natural? Does it sound like actual people talking as opposed to me really trying to kind of force through either plot or ideas? Yeah. And yeah, I guess that having the history for the character really helps with that, as you can pull little ideas from their childhood. Like, you'd know how they'd react to something because they grew up poor, for example. You don't need to tell the audience that they grew up poor, but by you knowing that, you it's there.
Yeah. Does each character sort of have a different voice? Do they sound different in your head than you can vocalize them?
Yeah, especially with Frank. Like, I had quite a lot of fun with once some of the less human characters enter the plot, then they all had quite specific voices. And I actually, more so than I have done in other stories, I kind of played with the phonetic kind of writing for their dialogue so that you really felt like a voice with each character. But yeah, definitely, like I could probably do really awkward impressions of the characters in my stuff speaking or whatever.
We're not asking you to do it. I was just really curious about it. Because I know that I have characters in my head that sound really different and I'm trying to figure out how to make my voice do the thing that my brain's doing.
Yeah.
I don't know what the answer to the question is, but it's just like, it's in there somewhere. I did take voice lessons that just try and start to learn about that, just to try and sort of be able to bring that onto stage at least. One thing that I was kind of really curious, really interested in, is at the back of the Frank on the Farm, at least the omnibus edition, I think, that you've got some notes and stuff based upon the stuff that you've written and the stuff that Clark Bint has kind of provided. And there's a couple of really interesting points where you've been like really explicit about how a scene looks, mm-hmm. and about how you want a page to look. How did you like, I kind of want to know, because my brain doesn't do that. I want to know how that works. And that's the stupidest question I can think of.
You mean like, how do I visualize a scene? Like, yeah, when I've got a very clear idea. I guess, yeah,
do
I do
just
kind
know?
Of. Yeah, I think it is. Yeah, it does. It's not very helpful to anyone
trying to get
some tips. But yeah, you just sometimes get some really strong. I guess it's a bit like what we were talking about with the characters, where you kind of get to really know the character and you know what they'll do. And there'll be certain scenes where you're really like, yeah, this is exactly how I want this to look. And I say in the collection that there's certain scenes where I feel like that, and it's very much like me really kind of trying to almost like I've seen the scene and I'm gonna try and explain as much of it to Clark as possible so that he can kind of recreate that. And then there's other times where I've got a general idea of what needs to happen, but Clark's an incredible artist and incredibly creative, so I will just, like with the nightmare scenes, I generally just gave him some bullet points about what needed to be in there, and then just gave him kind of free rein on exactly what he wanted to do. So yeah, I guess Alan Moore is the famous one for writing the kind of like a 22-page comic script would be like 1,000 A4 pages, because he'd be so fixated on exactly what he wanted in every panel. So I guess I probably have like 8 pages per issue where I'm kind of Alan Moore, and then maybe the rest of the time I'm more like a Garth Ennis or something in terms of being a bit more free with the artist.
Sure.
And that comes down a bit. I was just going to say that comes down a bit to your relationship with the artist as well. Like,
of course,
in quarantine, I was probably a lot more Alan Moore-y on kind of every page because people are only doing one page. I haven't worked with them before, and I didn't want to make people redo too much stuff. So if it came back and it didn't match with other stuff in the book because I hadn't given them enough information, then that would be a problem. But yeah, once you get a good relationship with an artist and you kind of know what their strengths are, it's good to get out of their way sometimes and let them use their strengths.
It's really interesting to see how different the sort of like visual from writing brain sort of like works, whether it's left and right brain, I don't know, but the way that those two parts of the brain work, and I can have a vision of like a sort of almost a director like vision of like, okay, this is where I want the camera to possibly be, and this is what I want to possibly see about things. But it's really tricky for at least for me to put into words, but it's maybe down to just practice. Maybe that's what it needs to be.
I think people are different. I think different writers, I know some writers who are very much like they get the story idea and they know kind of what the general story is, but they don't have a strong visual concept of what they want to see. I guess it's maybe like, because comics is this weird place between kind of film and novels or short stories, and maybe your brain either leans a bit more to someone who's a bit more filmic coming to comics, or someone who's a bit more of a prose writer coming to comics. And that maybe that's kind of where the change is. And that because I come from a cinema background, I tend to kind of really see stuff visually and imagine scenes as opposed to just having a kind of a story and knowing what the people say to each other, but without too much idea of the world they're inhabiting.
Oh yeah, I was going to say, because obviously with your experience in filmmaking and probably with making your own short films as well, and I'm guessing have you in any of the short films or any of the short films that you've sort of worked on, have you had to be the writer and then also the director at the same time?
No, I never directed anything. It was always collaborations with directors.
Right. Yeah, so I mean, even just taking that sort of having that sort of film vision there, and then also working with a comic artist who then can bring in that sort of, like, you know, you probably have a really good idea of how films flow, but then might not be too sure on how sort of like making a comic flow, then having that sort of artist on there kind of like saying, I can do this. Mm. I mean, I'm completely the opposite. Like, I can see and quite well explain like something, but if someone explains something to me, I'm like, what are you talking about? I can't see that. They literally have to show me and they go, oh, okay, now I get it.
You're saying you're a bad listener.
And that.
There is that.
I blame that to my dyslexia. I blame everything on my dyslexia.
Yeah, that's fair enough. That's fair enough. Yeah, I think, again, it's one of the things that improv has tried to teach me, is tried to just, like, listen more. Because, like, you pick up so much more when you're just kind of really attentive and, like, I'm going to use really heavy words now, like present in the moment.
Moment.
Sorry. Hippie words. It's because I've joined a cult.
It's when he says, that's why today is a gift, because it's the present. That's when you've got to worry.
I'm getting there. I'll work on it. I'll work it into normal everyday language. That was a real mishmash of things we spoke about. And those are like most of the notes that I wrote. Oh no, I've run out of notes, Nathan. Help me. That's not good.
Shall we take a little break and get some fresh water, and then we can come back and we can get on with the drawing part of things.
We'll do that.
And we can ask more questions along the way.
What I'll do is I'll roll the d20 first, and then we'll move these out of the way, hopefully, and not knock everything over. Ooh, that is a 6. A 6 means I've got like a little device thing that tells me what it is. Fantasy.
Fantasy.
Which we interpret however we want.
Yeah, it's a pretty open one.
It's pretty open. Most of them, I try to keep them as open as we possibly can. I've slowly started to add more and more genres that I'm going to add to the list eventually.
Oh, bless you.
And we get 2, just in case the first one you didn't like, or you want more than one, and you want to do genre mashing. And I think 20 is Wild West.
Okay, Wild West fantasy.
I think that's the wrong number.
I think 19's Wild West.
I don't know anymore. It's been so long.
We can just say it's
Wild West. No, it is Wild West.
Uh-huh, there so you go. Know them better than I do.
It's because they're in alphabetical order. yeah, because I'm a nerd. It's just how my brain works, I'm afraid. So yeah, how do you feel about fantasy and Wild West?
Yeah, that sounds fine to me.
On our dice, we've got some sort of face. Quirky face, I'm going to say, a shooting star, a arrow thing of all directions, shapes and forms, a clock, an eye, an electric bolt of some sort, a foot, a dice, and a moon.
And these can be interpreted in any sort of way.
And if you think of the genres, is there anything that comes to your brain, genre, Jordan, that you just think, that would be great to play with? And then we will start there.
Yeah, sure. A degenerate gambler in our Wild West fantasy world gets sent out on a quest by a giant eye.
Nice. Nice. Are we talking like the whole eyeball here, or just like a weird, like, opening in the universe, like a crack in the universe that then becomes an eye? Or does he meet like a massive eyeball, including its tendrils that like affix somewhere in the ground?
It's just like a little eyeball with like legs and a cowboy hat on.
Or that.
And he loses a bet. And he's like, right, you gotta do what I say, boy.
He's gambling with the eyeball.
With the eye.
So we got.
Thought you could hustle him.
Yeah.
It didn't work.
Yeah, didn't work. There we go. I have no idea what we've just created, but I love it. So a gambler is gambling against a fellow cow eye, cowboy eye, cowgirl eye, cow non-gender specific eye. They get sent on some sort of quest. I like it. Maybe he got sent on this quest because of an unlucky roll on the dice. We all know that snake eyes is like the worst thing to get on dice.
That's probably what the eyeball said. He was like, snake eyes is my lucky number because that's my name.
Yeah. Except snake eyes McGee.
Snake eye.
And maybe in this world they have no like power. So it's it was once kind of a world of machines and machinery and stuff like that. They've got no power anymore. So the thing that he's sent out to do is to try and find the electricity represented by the lightning, to try and capture lightning in a bottle, if you will.
As you do, perfectly normal thing to do.
Maybe that's even like the currency in this.
Currency is lightning.
The currency is electricity.
Nice.
So a bit like in a Mad Max where it's like everything's run, like that guy's in charge because he has all the water and he kind of keeps people under the boot from that. There's a kind of equivalent for electricity or power here, and they want to free the populace from the tyranny of the electricity hoarder.
Okay. I'm going to start drawing a thing and it's going to turn out horribly wrong. But that's just what I do. This electricity hoarder, I'm going to say, is just like a massive rattlesnake because we live in a fantasy world. But obviously, because it's Wild West, he's wearing a hat because it's Wild West. Because, you know, you can't have people in the Wild West without wearing a hat or some sort of... old school dress, depending upon what type of time of day it thinks it is. So
I can see the rattlesnake in some kind of one of those madam's gowns from one of the old West brothels.
yeah, that kind of thing. And this is our antagonist. Yes, antagonist. That's what I wanted to say. I always get antagonist and protagonist kind of mixed up for some reason. And I have to remind myself of which one is which. Okay. I've drawn a big snake with a hat. It's the first time I've drawn a big snake with a hat. That's a thing I've never drawn before. Considering how little I draw.
Well, we've got to draw some big boobies to go in that bustier.
Snake on the bustiers.
I don't know how would...
I don't make the rules here.
Okay, fine. Fine. You want snake boobs, you'll get them.
Finally.
What have you always wanted? Some sort of, instead of, because they're normally like whalebone corsets, so they'd have to be the opposite. I don't know what the opposite of whalebone corsets would be. Maybe human bone corsets, because like, you know, humans are just rubbish in this world. And I've got to draw a big eye person. That's what I've also, I'm just inspired to draw a big eye with a Tangellan hat. Like I say, the story doesn't have to make any sense whatsoever. But it's currently making a lot of sense. Just good. I think
so we've
this,
got a kind of a. Sorry.
Go for it.
I was just going to recap where we've got a we've got a degenerate gambler who somehow, from losing a bet, has been sent off on a quest into the desert by a eye wearing a 10-gallon hat to try and find the key to power to free the populace of the world from. And tyranny. So we've got a lot of the dice have been I guess there's a deadline. We've got the clock, so there must be some kind of reason this needs to happen soon before it's too late.
I think the snake has sort of captured the rest of the city and making them run in like a really large hamster wheel, just like not as universal. They're taking turns. Maybe it has to have two or three people like managing the hamster wheel to generate the power. Is kind of where I'm going with this.
Okay, so he's so that's the, what makes they've been sense. Enslaved to yeah. to generate yeah. this, and then he's that's profiting from it anyway.
Absolutely, that's why he's super evil. And then selling the electricity.
That's how
on.
Super evil works.
Super evil works. Slavery. Yes, sure.
I don't think anyone's going to disagree with that.
I don't. Okay, great. I was going to draw a hat with some weird legs. And one very large eye. This is where the podcast medium doesn't quite work. But I'm not giving up on it. I refuse to give up on it. Maybe that.
Are you guys, are you Western fans?
I like a good Western. I like, I was a big fan of like really the old school stuff, like Lee Van Cleef. And obviously people like Clint Eastwood in the old films, but then they started to start to reinvent them. Like the new version of The Magnificent Seven was pretty yeah. good, I thought.
Okay, yeah, I've not seen but that. I think I considered watching it recently. It's on one of the various apps that I've got.
Yeah, but I I really didn't like, maybe it's just me and Adam Sandler, I don't really get on well with his stuff. I don't want to put him down too much, but like, I just don't really get on well with his stuff. He did a film called The Ridiculous Six, which I just didn't work for me.
I think you've only got yourself to blame for seeing a Western starring Adam Sandler called The Ridiculous Six and thinking, yes, that is the film for me tonight.
I'll give it a go. But then I quite liked the guy who did Family Guy. He did A Million Ways to Die in the West.
Ah, yeah.
Which was also pretty good. Although I think I watched it a second time and I liked it less the second time. So it's maybe just a one view and I'm done sort of deal.
Yeah, because I feel like Westerns were like the biggest thing for 40 odd years, but they're not quite so prolific now. I think 3:10 to Yuma, have you seen that film? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that's a banging more recent Western. Although I say more recent, it's probably like 10 or 15 years old or something now. But yeah, within my lifetime anyway, that's absolutely. One of the best ones that I've kind of seen.
And Django Unchained.
Oh yeah. Yeah, love Django.
Big fan of that. Until the point that Leonardo DiCaprio comes into it. But that's because again I have an issue with Leonardo DiCaprio.
Okay, I thought you were going to say until the point where Quentin turns up, because that's the bit. Because that film, I think that film's great up until the point where the whole kind of ending pauses, so that Quentin Tarantino can have like an extended cameo as a racist Australian. I think is the part that he's opted to give himself, and then it just that kind of happens for like 20 minutes, and then they get through that, and then they just go straight back to what was happening already.
That's a fair comment. For me, it's just like Leonardo DiCaprio kind of ruined that movie, and the quicker he died was the better I started liking it.
he's in it from like half an hour in, though.
Not in real life, just in the film.
Yeah, it's long enough. I don't want to put his work completely down, but I've only liked one of his films ever. And maybe that's just on me. Maybe it is some sort of weird personal vendetta.
What is the film that you like of Leonardo DiCaprio? Is it Blood Diamond? You really enjoy him doing a slightly roofy South
it's
African
the beaches,
accent.
Isn't it? It's no. The Beaches.
I think Beaches is with, what's her name? Flying Without Wings, Bette Midler. I think that's a different film. Yeah. I think you're thinking
The Beach.
The Beach. Beaches. The Beaches was the sequel.
There's only one beach in that.
Singular beach versus many beaches. It's an easy mistake to make, Nathan.
Yeah,
I've been to the beach where the beach was supposed to be filmed.
I thought your brain was gone just completely doolally then and just went, I've been to a beach.
I've been to Brighton. Brighton's not a beach. It's a falsehood of a beach.
Look, just because it hasn't got sand on it doesn't mean it's not a beach. It's got a pier, it sells chips. That's enough.
What more do you want? I want actual sand. Is that too much to ask?
So which was your favourite Leonardo DiCaprio film, or the only yeah. one that you like?
I didn't avoid that question. I just forgot that you asked it. It's the World According to Garp.
What's Eating Gilbert Grape?
What's Eating Gilbert Grape? Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I don't know what my brain did with that. Yeah, it's him and Johnny Depp.
Yeah, yeah. He's young though, isn't he? Yeah, he's like 13 or 14 in it. I just remember him crying in the tree.
Yes, yeah. I don't know if that's what made it for me. I just
you like to see him cry. Any film where Leonardo DiCaprio's unfulfilled is all right. So you like the end of Titanic?
That's what
you like the end of Romeo and Juliet?
Actually, yeah, I did. I did like the Romeo and Juliet, but like again, I think I liked it because I just like Romeo and Juliet rather than I liked his portrayal of Romeo and Juliet in it.
He did play both of them, of course. Yeah. He did portray both Romeo and Juliet, which is probably what took you out of it.
Nope, I've lost all faith.
I still have never ever seen the end of Titanic to the point where I did borrow it from one person. They said, oh, can I have it back? And I did actually say, no, I want to find out what happens at the end. And I obviously knew. And obviously, I just wanted to see how the film played out.
They all die in the end. That's spoiler alert.
Well, lucky for you, Leonardo DiCaprio dies at the end. So.
Yeah, Leo dies, but Kate, because Kate won't let him on that bit of door.
Yeah.
There's plenty of not enough there. Space.
He's like, oh, no. No,
I like to stretch out. Yeah.
Murder is kind of what we wanted in that life. I haven't drawn the gambler yet, but I've kind of got to the point where I don't know where to put him. And I've given the snake a cigar that might look a bit like his tongue. I will add in our gambler, but I'm going to show our guest my drawing and let Jordan interpret it however he wants.
Okay. Oh, that's a very big dice. Or is it a very small table?
Well, the jury's out on that one.
Is that a testicle with a hat? Sure. I don't remember the testicle dice, but fair enough. The rattlesnake's looking good. Quite the cast there.
Yeah, it's quite the cast. I tried to give the eyelashes. I think that's what made it look a little bit more like a testicle.
It's always a risk when drawing an eye. I know the Renaissance painters always struggled a lot with that concern of covering people's faces in testicles by accident.
Some people really would enjoy that kind of thing.
I did. I also went for the eye. I didn't go for the full cast, but... that's my cowboy eye on kind of weird,
huge legs.
Yeah, kind of weird, long tentacle legs with little booties.
Amazing. See, it's the boots that are important.
His poor feet in that kind of time. They didn't clean the saloons regularly. There'd be broken glass and things everywhere. You can't be walking around on exposed tentacles.
Give him some jingly jangly spurs, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get that whole, when you walk into the saloon, you get that k-tsh, k-tsh, k-tsh moment.
Yeah, he didn't want to let just being an eye kind of keep him from taking part in the latest fashions.
Sure, I can appreciate that. I drew a rainbow with some cowboy boots once. I think that was a thing.
Yeah, and a cowboy riding it.
And a cowboy riding the rainbow.
We've had to draw a lot of cowboys in the series of this podcast.
It's good improvement.
I still don't know how to draw a Stetson. Look, so
You can draw as many hats as you like, and you can draw them in any way you like. That's
it's hard getting the dip in the top. I feel like that's a little bit of a step up in artistic skill than I'm capable of.
I would agree with you.
Does this mean that your next story might be a Western and you're going to rate your artists by how well they can draw a Stetson hat?
I guess that's important. I guess you need someone who can do Stetsons and horses, really. You know, that's your go-to for a Western. I'd quite like to do a Western, actually. I don't know if you guys read Pulp by Brubaker and Phillips that came out maybe last year or at the beginning of this year.
I haven't. I
don't think so, no.
That's a really cool... So it follows a cowboy type character, but who's quite old now, like in their 60s or something. And so now they're in like the 1930s and it's all cars and the Depression and stuff. So what it's like to have been a cowboy, like robbing banks and riding around on horses, and then to kind of have to adapt to life in a big city as kind of as the world changed. But yeah, it's a really, really good comic. I think it won the Eisner for like best original graphic novel or something.
Nice. I was going to ask you if you have any sort of like major people you look up to, sort of like towards, or if you're now sort of, I don't want to say anybody's past that, but I always think that people look up towards other people for other stories for some reason. Maybe that's just me.
Yeah, you mean kind of like influences. And, I mean, I love Garth Ennis. I think he's a fantastic writer who's really good at mixing really grotesque, kind of over the top, even stupid stuff with a lot of heart in his stories, which I think's a really impressive. Like Hellblazer's like my favorite series of all time. Sure. I've got like all 300 issues of that original Vertigo run of Hellblazer. So a lot of the writers in that are ones I liked a lot, like Garth. And the Sean Phillips worked on that with Paul Jenkins. And I love all the Glenn Fabry covers on that stuff. But yeah, Ed Brubaker, I love a lot. I really loved Darwin Cook's work when he was still going. I guess, yeah, a lot of the kind of Vertigo stuff, Brian K. Vaughan, like Why the Last Man's one of my favorite series, which has the TV series going on at the moment. And
that's going to be Disney.
Jason Aaron, who did Scout, I think it's a really great book. Lucifer by Mike Carey is another one of my favorites.
That's a real kind of diverse sort of mishmash of people as well, which I think is like really useful for anybody just to like, you know, not to stick to one genre, but to embrace as many as you feel them. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I've always felt like I really like good stories. So if people, like when friends ask me, do I prefer writing the comics or novels or film scripts? But I don't really kind of break it down like that. It's always just a case of really enjoying stories. So yeah, when it comes to reading comics or even like novels and TV series, films, I don't have too many kind of genres that I always gravitate towards. It's always really just about finding the most kind of true feeling stories. That doesn't have to be true in terms of, oh, that's realistic, because obviously a lot of the stuff I like isn't realistic, but where you can tell like the creators really care about the characters and the world they've created.
I can sympathize with that. It's just like really getting invested in a character when you're reading it. It's like being affected by a story is kind of the way that I look at it. If I've had a few books that have really made me cry, just reading through them and getting the feelings I get from them. And so whenever that happens to me, I'm just like, what? I'm just reading a thing. How did that happen? How did emotions happen?
I guess novels are really a big one for that, in that you get to know a character so well by, obviously, you see all their actions and the kind of the actual things that they do, but then you're getting all their inner monologue generally as well, and understanding the motivations behind everything that they're doing, and you tend to get a very well-rounded character. I don't know if you do you know a book called Pachinko, which I've forgotten
I know
the,
of it.
The writer, but yeah, she I think she's her kind of family's from Korea, but I think she was born in America and grew up there, but kind of did a lot of digging into the past of her family. And it's like spans 80 years across Korea getting invaded by Japan and then the Second World War happening and all these things. And yeah, that's like literally like every kind of 25 pages you're crying in that one. But very good. It's very good.
Yeah. That's a good show. Good writing. That's what I say. If it's managed to sort of have some sort of effect on me. I did what, after being recommended it by a previous guest, I read In the Miso Soup, which is a Japanese sort of crazy out there horror book. And is way out there and just made me kind of cringe quite a lot through it, like physically kind of close my body off because I was really uncomfortable with what was happening. And again, to me, that's really good writing. It's like,
yeah, no, definitely. I get, because it's quite a, people say that kind of horror and stuff's quite hard to do in comics because as opposed to like a film, you've not got the soundtrack, you've not got that control over when something appears on the screen because it's down to the kind of reader as they read through the comic. So if you can really bring out some emotions in a horror story, then that's always a sign of something that's been really well done.
I think that actually your choice of I don't know who soundtracked the comic book, but you've actually released the comic book on YouTube as part of one of the rewards, I think.
All the books, all the physical. I think all the copies have a QR code so that you can go and watch the Frank the movie.
I think that's like a really nice way to do it, like being sort of like led through a story at a pace with a soundtrack, but no voiceover, which I also thought was really interesting as well, so that the person who's reading it can keep that voice in their head rather than have that sort of be influenced by an actor or somebody doing voiceover.
Yeah, so that's my friend actually here in Granada, a guy called John Vallely, who studied composing. And that started as him just doing a short piece for one of the nightmare scenes on the first Kickstarter that we did as a little kind of bonus reward. And he was kind of looking for projects to kind of learn how to use all this new equipment he had. So he rented a big project, and I really liked what he did. So I was happy for him to kind of go to town on it, and he did an amazing job with all that. It was when he kind of realized that you needed to really sync it up to the comic as opposed to just having people reading the comic physically with the music playing in the background that it really came to life. But yeah, no, that's I was really happy with how that all came out. And yeah, it does add that element of atmosphere, I guess. I think you can get a bit more of that creepiness, and it's probably a bit more of a scary experience if you kind of get really your kind of head into your iPad or your laptop watching it that way.
I think it does certainly add to that atmosphere of some of the scenes. I like, especially the opening sort of beautiful sort of orchestral scenes where you're just seeing like the land, and it's just like just the beginnings of the story. It really feels like the beginning of a film. And I know that's the whole point. But yeah, I'm trying to say he did a really good job.
he's a fantastically talented guy.
Nathan, do you have a drawing for us?
I do.
Yay!
There you go.
I stalled long enough. Yay. I'll have to move the camera just very slightly. There we go.
So I've done a little comic. Obviously, our gambler losing to our eye man.
And him just going, snake crash. See, you've done eyelashes correctly. You've not made it look like a testicle.
Can I see your testicle again?
I did too many eyelashes. That's the problem.
I think it's the bottom ones that lend it the sort of like a testicle looking thing.
I don't know what I'm doing. I'm not an artist. But I'm very proud of it nonetheless. I'm proud of my snake, and that's the most important bit. Well, Jordan, it's been wonderful to chat to you on this like kind of like whirlwind tour of your work and like your process and all sorts of other things. If you'd like to do some self-promo, now's a great time. If not, all of your links and bits and pieces will be in our description to the podcast. So don't worry if that makes you uncomfortable.
Oh, no, I've gotten pretty good at trying to schlock stuff around for the last couple of years at Kickstarter. So Frank at Home on the Farm that we've been speaking about, the collection, the hardback collection will be available at Thought Bubble, but the Kickstarter for that's finished. But my publisher, Scout Comics, have released a soft cover color edition of the full series, which is available from all good comic shops, and you can get it through their web store. And also that will be getting a release through actual bookstores early next year. So if you go onto Amazon now, I think you can actually pre-order it. So if you like the sound of that, then that's easy to get your hands on. And then on the first week of November, we will have launched the second issue of Weird Work on Kickstarter, which is the one I mentioned, which is kind of like a LA Confidential style story, but in a wild world like Futurama, where no one's really human. It's all kind of strange aliens and bizarre creatures and stuff like that. And that's with Shaky Kane, who's done a lot of work for Image, and he did some work on 2000 AD and Deadline back in the 80s. And so, yeah, so when this goes live, that should be available for people to buy. And you can also get all of my other comics, Quarantine that we mentioned, Mugshots, the crime one, and the hardback collection of Frank as add-ons on the Kickstarter. So that'll be a good opportunity if there was anything that anyone was interested in. And you can follow me on Twitter at Jordan_J_Thomas, where I'm always kind of posting stuff about comics and chatting with people. So if anyone's read any of my stuff and wants to get in touch, then yeah, that's probably the best place.
Cool. And as you say, like, as this has gone live, like, the Kickstarter should be live now, by the time that this goes out. Mm. So go back it.
Yeah, hopefully in the future, when this goes live, we're fully funded and we've got some pretty cool stretch goals. I guess I can say the stretch goals. They're a bit secretive now, but if you guys keep it under your hat or on top of your testicle, or whatever the way it works. We've got some pin-up stretch goals, one done by Michael Redd, who people will know from Ecstatics and Silver Surfer, like an amazing artist. Then we also have Krent Abel has done one, and Juan Jose Rip, who did he did Black Summer with Warren Ellis about 15, 20 years ago, and he's an insanely talented artist. They should all be hopefully in play by the time people see this or listen to this.
Fantastic work. So nice to like have these collaborations like coming to real life, and I think that's what makes comics like really kind of what they are, is they really are a collaboration of like hearts and minds of people. And I know that films are very sort of collaborative, but like, to me, I don't know, comic books just feel that smaller, more tighter relationship between the people. Maybe that's just how I see it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I guess it's like everyone's packed together on a small little kind of life raft instead of a great big steamliner. They say we're a bit more welcoming. We kind of try and get everyone on the door, unless there's a few creators out there who maybe kick a few people off into the water, but I won't name names on anyone.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode with Jordan Thomas.
Yeah, thank you, Jordan, for joining us.
Yeah, that sounded very like robotic, like I pieced it together. Thanks, Jordan. We really appreciated your time and your knowledge and your effort. Speaking to people like Jordan, and we just thought, there's a person that knows their stuff.
Yeah.
And we were just like, are we just like complete amateurs at everything? Yes, we are.
And by the time this episode actually airs, we might have actually even met Jordan face to face at Thought Bubble.
Yeah.
So,
and his next Kickstarter should now be live.
Mm.
So if you check out the links in the description, there will be some links probably to the Kickstarter for Weird Work Part 2. And as part of the bonuses or part of the extra content that you can pick up as part of that, yeah, Jordan says that there should be copies of Weird Work and Quarantine and Mugshot and other things that he's written. So if you want to catch up on all of his things, it would be a great time to do that and back the second issue of Weird Work.
Also, you can always get in contact with us. You've got any feedback, you've got any drawings yourself, you can always contact us at roughsketchpod@gmail.com or any of our social medias as well in the description below.
Send us pictures of cowboy eyeballs and snakes with boobs. Because it's the first time I've drawn a snake with boobs. I want to see what other people do. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. We really appreciate your time. Feel free to tell a friend about our podcast and do all those wonderful things. We are eager to hear from you.
Yes, our next episode should be on the 3rd of December.
Something like that.
Mm.
Yeah. Until then, take care of yourselves, be creative, have fun.
Bye-bye.
Ta-da.